We regret that due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to bring you San Francisco at this time.
Feeling.
We take you now to San Francisco.
And the war ends.
Come in, Mr. Kaltenborn.
What actually happened is that there is a long process when peace ceases to exist and war begins to come, and then, at a given moment, such as that at Pearl Harbor, there is a dramatic opening of the actual fighting. Well, similarly, when a war ends, the shooting ceases first here and there, in one country or another. There is one surrender and then another, and then finally, whatever authority is left in the defeated countries makes some sort of an arrangement with the victorious countries, and then, for the sake of the people, more than to give them any news, there is an official proclamation that the war is over. Well, that's the sort of thing that's been happening now for the past few weeks. We could have proclaimed VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, at any time for at least 2 weeks past, and it would have been a perfectly legitimate thing. Because obviously, in a war that is as far extended as this, that covers as many parts of the world, that has overrun all of Europe, that has left pockets of resistance in a score of islands in the Mediterranean, in the English Channel, in the pockets of France, at the harbors on the western part of France, in various parts of Austria, of Czechoslovakia, of Germany, of Denmark, of Norway, it's probably impossible that the war could actually end at any given moment, because no matter who is in charge in Germany now, he is not in such complete charge that he controls all the German elements that are still fighting. And we have just had a bulletin to the effect that even though it may all be true that Admiral Dönitz and General Krosigk have signed some sort of formal document with the Allies for a complete surrender, those troops in Czechoslovakia, who are acting more or less independently under their commander there, said that they would not surrender unless they were guaranteed free passage across Czechoslovakia back into Germany. Perhaps they don't realize the extent to which Germany is already occupied by Allied forces. And then, on this particular war end, we have another complicating feature. We have the fact that while the Germans have now reached the point where they are completely willing to surrender to Great Britain and the United States, they do not wish to surrender to the Soviet Union. And yet, for our part, we cannot accept any such partial surrender. We are under obligations to the Soviet Union in a signed and sealed document that the surrender is to be joint, that it is to be addressed to all three powers. And we would be unfaithful to our obligations to the Soviet Union if, when it comes to a general surrender on the government level, that is, as between Dönitz and Krosigk, and perhaps Himmler on the one hand, and either General Eisenhower or the three governments on the other, because Eisenhower does represent the Allied governments, well, unless we get it on something less than the government level, we couldn't take it unless it were addressed to all three powers. And a large part of the negotiation that's been going on during the past week just concerns the unwillingness of the Germans to make the surrender to Russia and our unwillingness to accept the surrender that does not formally include the Soviet Union. That's been the fundamental trouble. That's why we've had these various false reports. That's why there have been meetings of various kinds between German emissaries and American and British emissaries trying to work out that particular point. Well, let's assume that now we've finally gotten Dönitz and Krosigk and whatever there is of a German government, that government that has been moving from Berlin to Kiel and then from Kiel into Denmark and from Denmark perhaps back to Flensburg on the Danish-German frontier. That government has now decided, all right, we'll surrender to all three governments. Well, if that has happened, why then naturally Dönitz would issue a report to his submarine commanders urging them to cease fighting. But you can't tell what a German submarine commander would do under those circumstances. He might prefer to continue to go on his own. He might try to reach Spain or Argentina in the hope that he could hole up there, or at least that he wouldn't have to surrender his ship to the enemy, that he could find refuge in a neutral port. And it's also quite possible that some of those submarine commanders would give up. For example, they might take their ships into British ports or even into American ports, depending on where they happen to be located when that word comes. It certainly does not mean that our Navy is going to assume that all German submarines will hereafter be good and that they will go on as though peace were already restored. No, this is an instance where the transition from war to peace has been a very slow one, has been very partial, and will not be completed by the mere announcement that the shadow government which has succeeded the Hitler-Göring-Goebbels regime is now in a position to control everybody who is still fighting. We have here the complete disintegration, first of an alliance and then of a nation. You will remember that the story of capitulations wholesale began in Italy, following the great offensive by the 5th and the 8th armies, which had worked valiantly and without much success throughout the winter and into the spring before the great bastion of Bologna. Then suddenly they launched their offensive some 6 weeks ago. They began driving forward steadily. There was no holding them. And after overcoming the first line of German resistance, they drove in across the plains of the Po River and behind Bologna. And the German commander in that area, after token resistance for another 2 weeks, saw that it was all over and decided that he would give up the fight. And then after a certain amount of negotiation, there was a local military surrender in the Italian area between General Alexander, representing the Allies, and the German commander, according to which something like 600,000 German troops gave up their arms. Well, that was the beginning, but that covered only Italy and the western part of Austria. There were still other troops fighting in Austria, fighting in Czechoslovakia, in Germany, and all over Scandinavia. And so that was only point one in this surrender. Well, then came point two. We had the continued advance of the 3rd and the 7th armies down south towards Austria. We had the further drive on the part of the British in the north. And the second really great surrender came to the British armies under General Montgomery. The Germans in the north pulled back from their Russian front, and as many of them as could surrendered to General Montgomery. That negotiation came on the German-Danish border. That also involved something like 500,000 troops. We really don't know exactly how many, because the numbers are so large that they have still been unable to count them all. And then that followed a complete success by the British forces in driving up towards a junction with the Russians near the Baltic, beyond Hamburg, in the area between Hamburg and Stettin. Well, there too, the British had taken close to 500,000 soldiers before the formal surrender, which gave them another 500,000. However, all that adds up to perhaps a total of 2 million troops involved. And as we know, the Germans still had a matter of 5 or 6 million. We must remember that they had mobilized this Volkssturm, which, while it was not particularly efficient, was yet an organized military force. And so there were, in addition to these two armies that surrendered, huge armies that were being prepared, that were being drilled, that were being held in reserve, in addition to those that were at the front. And, of course, the Germans have had probably their best remaining available forces fighting against the Russians. The Russians succeeded in taking Berlin only with a magnificent effort. Let no one suppose that they had an easy time in their last final drive across the Oder River between Frankfurt and Breslau and that march forward towards Berlin. That was a very hard struggle that will stand out as one of the most brilliant Russian campaigns of the entire war, because the Germans had definitely established their strongest, most determined resistance in that particular area east of Berlin. But the Russian offensive there covered a relatively small area. It was only some time later that they also succeeded in driving through Stettin. And even after they got that far, they still met tremendous German resistance. And then came that rather curious relation between the American army advancing across the Elbe in the direction of Berlin and the Russians marching west of Berlin. We could have taken Berlin. Frankly, I'm convinced of that on the basis of the military situation as it stood after we had made our plunge through Germany, had reached the Elbe, and had crossed the Elbe at least three different points. And we were pushing forward, and I'm convinced could have pushed forward, when orders were received from General Eisenhower to go back to the river and to take up the line that had been agreed upon between Russia and the United States and Great Britain for the Russian occupation. You see, what makes this war rather more complicated is this matter of the Allies, of their respective zones of occupation, of the German unwillingness to surrender to Russia what they're now entirely willing to surrender to Britain and the United States. And because of that situation, we've got to be particularly careful and particularly tactful not to give the Russians the impression that we are perfectly willing to accept something from the Germans which is not in complete accord with our previous agreements. And that's one reason why everybody in Britain and the United States is leaning over backwards so as to make no public announcement that might be misunderstood by the Russians as our having accepted a German surrender in which they are equally interested, which they have done so much to enforce, and which they are entitled to announce at the exact moment that we announce it. And there you come to the different situation that exists in news services and in the handling of news in the Soviet Union and in the United States. Now, I venture to say that at this particular time, President Truman might think what a happy thing it would be if at certain moments in history, a president of the United States had absolute command of the news services and could determine just when they should and when they should not make certain announcements. Now, in Soviet Russia, where I have worked as a newspaper man, there is absolutely no difficulty because nobody can say anything to anybody by way of print unless a government official has first okayed it. So no one representing the press of the Soviet Union is in Europe trying to score what we call a beat on the announcement of an armistice. But look at the conditions with respect to the news services in the United States and Britain. All of them have been keyed for weeks to be ready for this announcement, not to permit one news service to get it ahead of the other. And so they've all been watching. They've been following the individuals who've been carrying on the negotiations. And obviously, negotiations have gone on continuously. Don't forget that so far as the Italian surrender alone is concerned, the negotiations began in the middle of March and were only completed a few days ago. Therefore, the negotiations for surrender, insofar as an existing German government can provide for it, those negotiations have been underway. And the alert newsmen of Britain and the United States have been following them. And this morning, we heard from one of them who thought that he has the correct announcement with regard to what has happened. Now, my guess is that he probably has some very definite information. But since VE Day is to be officially proclaimed, that means that it will...